You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, July 7th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Matt Huber, professor at Syracuse University and author of Climate Change's Class War, Building Socialism on a Warming Planet. Meanwhile, Boris Johnson is officially resigning as prime minister after dozens of his cabinet members took the lead on that front. Down goes Bojo to make way for another terrible Tory. Back in the U.S., cops say that the Highland Park shooter admitted that he was contemplating a second massacre at a parade in Wisconsin, which is where he fled. Emails show that Biden had planned to nominate the anti-abortion Republican to a lifetime federal judgeship on the day that Roe got overturned. They scrapped that.
Come on, man.
Roe getting overturned really messed with my announcement. My big deal with Mitch.
For what?
For peanuts. Rolling Stone has obtained audio from the leader of an anti-abortion activist group saying that she prayed with the Supreme Court justices. Didn't say who. Hasn't been verified, but that's what was said. Try again. Schumer is gearing up for another dance with Joe Manchin on drug prices. A bill that would allow Medicare to negotiate directly with manufacturers, but with a few industry-friendly tweaks this time around. France will nationalize its largest utility company, EDF, with the Russian war in Ukraine being the final nail in that coffin. We should take note here in the United States. It's now been being discovered that James Comey was conveniently the subject of a 2017 hyper-intensive audit on his taxes. A kind of audit only done to 5,000 people in the whole country in a year. So that was during Trump's tenure. Just odd timing. Workers at an Amazon warehouse in Kentucky are officially unionizing with Amazon Labor Union. And lastly, WNBA star Brittany Griner has pleaded guilty to drug charges in Russia. What this means for her release, I do not know. But free Brittany Griner. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to another edition of the Majority Report, as we say, here on Thursday. Just Matt and I today. So not a double, what do you call it?
The skeleton crew.
Yeah, skeleton crew. It's a two-hander. We're going to be talking to Matt Huber in a bit for a conversation that I'm very much looking forward to, because I just had a debate over the weekend about with family about individual action.
You are really debating your family lately.
I don't want to, but they always ask me questions, and it's just it's combative. That's the nature of it.
See, I have maybe a more conservative family, but they also they do ask me a lot of questions because they know what line of work I'm in, and they're often I think because they're farther away from me, they're willing to be more persuaded by me in a weird way. As if we were close together, it might be a little bit more contentious.
Yeah, I mean, it's also just how I grew up. One, it's probably why I'm in this field, because that was such an emphasis in my family. But two, it's they kind of get off on challenging me for some reason. And it's not my favorite thing, which oddly, so I'm the one that wants to disengage the most based on that dynamic. But I digress. Individual action on climate change and emphasizing personal consumptive choices is not the way to go. is my stance on that, and I'll be fleshing that out with Matt Huber. But I wanted to return to Uvalde, because it is important that we keep the spotlight on the fallout from the massacre at Robb Elementary in Uvalde, Texas. Cops are continuing to try to wait it out so the spotlight gets a little less hot on the incredible depth of their incompetence and failure. And
I've been hearing weird reports of traffic stops and stuff like that, maybe some intimidation. Are
oh, of the woman that's, yeah. that spoke out and tried to jump the fence and spoke about their... Yes, yep. She a few weeks ago, she spoke to the press and said essentially that she's terrified because they've been the cops have been blaring their sirens and yeah. have been waiting outside her home.
And I don't like the feds either, but in a context like this, like I think the onus is on and pressure should be put on the federal government to send their forces down there. So there's at least more of a light on it, because Texas police are, I mean, even for cops, just in like mendacious lying culture about like things as severe as dead kids.
Yeah. And I, in terms of the feds, Joaquin Castro, a representative from Texas, has called for an FBI investigation. I'm again, no fan of the FBI, but there needs to be some sort of federal oversight on this.
While there's the FBI, let's point it towards the cops.
Exactly. Right. So credit to CNN here. They are not letting up, and they interviewed teacher Arnie Reyes, one of the survivors of the massacre. Here is his recounting of what he witnessed and how long it took for the cops to arrive.
Arnie Reyes was the only survivor from classroom 111 at Robb Elementary in Uvalde, Texas. After a month in the hospital, 10 surgeries from bullet wounds to his arm and back, he is finally back home and talking about the day that ripped so many lives apart.
I was getting the kids under the table. I turned around, and when I turned around, I saw him. But I just saw, like, the shadow. And that's when I saw the two, like, the fire. And then I ended up on the ground as well.
And so you get hit. And you go down. Mm-hmm. And what's going on in your mind at that time?
I'm just thinking and waiting for somebody to come and save us. You always think, you know, something bad is happening, that the cops get there so fast. They rush in and they help you, you know. And I was just waiting for that. I was waiting for anybody to come save us.
We now know it would be a long and agonizing 74 minutes before police would enter Reyes's classroom to kill the gunman.
He did a lot of things to make me flinch or react in some way. And that was one of them, where he like got my, like, as I'm laying down, like either like this or like this, tapping it, but it was splashing on my face.
The blood.
Yeah.
Was he trying to see if you were still alive?
I think so.
You're laying there for over an hour, right? And no one's coming to help. What do you think of that?
That they forgot us. I mean, they probably thought that we were all dead or something, but if they would have gone in before. Some of them probably would have made it.
It's a question many are struggling with as precious seconds.
Yeah, so, I mean, credit to the bravery of Arnie Reyes there. I mean, like, the fact that the immediate right-wing response, I can't get over this, because they've abandoned this because the facts don't even approach anything close to, like, a case that they could make to blame the teachers. But, you know, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick was out there blaming teachers for not closing doors. And the
teacher, which was a lie planted by the cops.
Exactly. And the cops' lies continue to drip, drip, drip out. Yesterday, the Advanced Law Enforcement Rapid Response Training Report indicated that there was a cop that had the shooter in the cop's crosshairs and could have shot the shooter and held off on firing to, quote, await confirmation from his supervisor, which was that was the entirety of this, right? Which was a lot of people standing around, twiddling their thumbs, waiting for some sort of authority, even though they had all of the training, the requisite training, that is supposed to stop this.
The book says once you have two or more people, you breach and stop the killing. That's like literally the handbook.
And they didn't do it. And so this is why, one, putting empowering cops through more more weaponry, through more funding, when Biden chants fund the police at the State of the Union, because they have this perception that it doesn't go over well with the suburban voters, who are the only people that they seem to care about at this point. The consequences of that are just more money taken away from communities that would help them and going towards cops who will do absolutely nothing with it. And we have a case in point. And let's play this from the most recent massacre, or one of the more recent massacres. There was a shooting in Philly as well, and I'm sure there will be one very soon. But the Highland Park massacre that happened on July 4th, this is a reporter speaking to Highland Park police about how the shooter, Bobby Cremo, was able to legally buy the gun after he had two wellness checks on him and had other weaponry like knives taken away from him because of the threats that he was making, how that did not set off some sort of red flag law in Illinois when that's supposed to happen under their state regulations.
Four background checks despite these reports. Sir, the shooter passed four background checks despite these reports of an attempted suicide and the fact that he said he wanted to kill everyone and had this knife collection. How is that possible in a state with some of the strictest gun laws, and how frustrating is that for you?
So a couple things. I made these comments yesterday that I think we need to increase our awareness about the red flag law. We can certainly get you the details of that red flag law. We have a little bit of information about that today.
Law enforcement says because the shooter's family didn't press charges or request weapons be taken away as part of the red flag law, the troubling incidents did not impact him buying the guns.
Could the police have made that request, though, if the family didn't? Since the police went out to the home, could they have?
It's on a case-by-case basis, and it would depend on the individual information.
So the answer to that is yes. The police could have flagged this, and they could have used their discretion in order to plant that red flag, but they did not. And so, but these twin instances, these twin mass shootings, but one which has an incredibly egregious police response that could be covering up something larger, we still do not know, which is why there needs to be a federal investigation into this. And the kind of just standard police response here, which is to not take these kinds of things seriously, it just goes to show that leaving gun control in the hands of the discretion of cops and responding to gun violence and massacres like this is not the right way to go. And you know what? The bipartisan bill put together by Cornyn and others, heralded as this big victory, does exactly that. It gives law enforcement more discretion and more and wider potentially, we don't know the full details of it because it has to go to the House and get fleshed out, but potentially gives them more funds in order to combat gun violence. It's all empowering law enforcement to this degree. It's the wrong way to go. You need to target the manufacturing and the sale of this weaponry. These kinds of weapons should not be on the streets.
Yeah, wanting to buy that weapon is a red flag in and of itself. I saw this yeah. thread of, you know how gun pedants always get in there and be like, well, it's actually this, 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 and so you can't do that, that, that. They were convinced that that was an AK-47. And they're like, look at all the people that are going to say that he bought it legally, right? Well, guess what? It wasn't. It was a gun that he actually bought legally. So now what? I mean, nobody should be able to buy that kind of weaponry. Like, even if you want to entertain, like, community self-defense, personal self-defense, or, like, needs for hunting, that is not necessary
no.
at all. Nothing remotely. Those magazines should be illegal, and modifying it should be illegal. And if you do it, you should go to jail.
Yep. So there's not much more to say, except that the focus on red flag laws is not going to help anything. And frankly, if I were a Democrat voting in the House on this kind of legislation, I would sink it. I do. There's zero value in giving Republicans a rhetorical victory where they can seem like they're more reasonable on gun control than they are for legislation that's going to do absolutely nothing and might actually have negative effects, because it gives law enforcement, gives cops who have been proven to be incompetent at best nationwide more power, which is the exact wrong thing that we need right now.
Yeah, as they tell us to go out and protest for abortion rights, they're giving the cops more money. Who's going to be smashing heads?
Yeah. More money for tear gas. All right, with that said, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Matt Huber. We are back, and we are joined now by Matt Huber, professor of at Syracuse University and author of Climate Change is Class War, Building Socialism on a Warming Planet. Matt, thank you so much for being here and doubling up on the maths today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, of course. So I mentioned this at the start of the show that many of the ideas that you discuss in your book have I've been debating them with certain people. Just the overemphasis on individual consumption versus a larger critique of production, and having this be at the feet of the government as opposed to individuals, and largely individuals who have the means and the time to engage in the process of cutting back on certain aspects of their consumption. So let's talk about that core tension that you explore in the book, consumption versus production, as an emphasis on climate change.
Yeah. The first thing to say is that we've kind of almost been trained to only think about the climate change and responsibility through consumption, where we get these carbon footprint calculators and we think about, you know, what we do in our homes, how we drive, what we eat, how we fly, whether or not we have children, like all these actions we do in the market as consumers can be traced to various kinds of emissions. And that way of thinking just pretty much erases the role of the people that own and control and profit from production. And, so, you know, like when you think of your carbon footprint as like driving and emitting a certain amount of emissions, like you're totally ignoring the role of the oil company that sold you that gasoline that's powering your car, and they're making all the money, they're making all the profit from that. And in a larger sense, like our energy system is an incredibly complex social system of production. You know, like the electric grid it's crazy. It has to be balanced, like supply and demand. So you have all these actors who are provisioning electricity to us. And that, if we were, you know, focusing on that relationship of production, is a lot more straightforward than all these kind of scattered, consumption acts. And, you know, the production is, for instance, if you were to take a coal-fired electric grid and turn it over to clean energy, the consumption acts can be the exact same, but they would be, from a climate perspective, completely different. So what the book tries to do is to say, really, the struggle over climate change is really about how we produce not just energy, but the things that use energy in our economy, like steel plants and cement plants and agriculture and all these productive infrastructures that use a lot of energy. Like, that's what we have to transform. So in a kind of old school kind of socialist way, like about seizing the means of production, like that's actually what this struggle is about. It's about really taking control of a system that's run for profit by capital, who controls it to just make money, to try to say we need to totally transform this energy production system to decarbonize it and make sure it runs on clean energy so we can, you know, save the planet from being uninhabitable. So there's a lot of other things I could say about how focusing on consumers and carbon footprints really distracts. Like, even when you focus on the rich and their sort of high emitting.
That was going to be my next question, right? Because, like, yeah. Just focusing on individual wealthy people's consumption is, but where are they consuming from, right?
Exactly.
Like, I mean, you have three pools at your three houses and you're flying to Timbuktu or wherever you're going. But you are consuming from someplace no matter how wealthy you are.
And by only focusing on what they're using their money for as rich people, we don't look at how they make their money.
Yeah.
And that activity is going to have way more carbon impact. So you could take a CEO of a fossil fuel company that spends like 12 hours a day, like managing a global network of fossil fuel extraction production systems. And yeah, maybe they might go home into their heated pool that uses a lot of energy, but their activity of being a fossil fuel exec is way more impactful than what they're doing in their private consumption life. And that's, you know, really where the power is. Because the other thing is, you know, when we think about our responsibility only in terms of consumers, we act as if the capitalist market system is really just this free market where decentralized consumers have the power to kind of choose and shape demand. And that's what's driving the economy. That's what shapes production. But, you know, a left perspective would say that's not how the economy works. It's really controlled by a small minority of owners who own production, who profit from these systems. And they're the ones with the real power. And so that's where we really have to pay attention. Because, Emma, I think you actually brought this up when we talked about this long ago. But, like, when you only look at someone's consumption, you could look at like a Hollywood actor who has a mansion and drives a Hummer and a private jet and compare that person with a fossil fuel executive, who takes public transit and is a vegetarian. And you would conclude that the Hollywood actor has more impact on the climate compared with the owner of fossil capital. It just makes absolutely no sense to think about it that way. So, we're really missing a lot when we only look at the consumptive realm. That's for sure.
And even on a rhetorical level, like, I mean, one, you mentioned that the solution that you're talking about is so much more straightforward. And my experience in covering politics is that often straightforward answers are a little bit scary for capitalists because it involves a class struggle. And the simple answer usually always boils down to that. But even from a political rhetorical level, like Democrats focusing on, we'll just use this country as an example because I'm most familiar with it, but any like center left party, whatever, focusing on individual consumption as a way to combat climate change is a gift to the right wing because it's an impossible bar to meet. It also is targeted at a certain class of likely suburbanites, upper middle class types, who have the ability to engage in that kind of behavioral change because of wealth and time and the kinds of education that they probably received. Like, it is almost working in tandem with the Democrats saying, basically, we're only going to focus on winning over suburban voters mm-hmm. who are disaffected by Trump. Like, that is the kind of person that they're tailoring that towards, and that has zero broad appeal.
Yeah. I mean, you can listen to what the right says about climate politics, and they say this is a conspiracy amongst a liberal elite that's trying to concoct these policies in Washington that are ultimately meant to change your life, to make your life worse, to make your life cost more, and to make you sort of adopt this sort of goody-goody, like vegan lifestyle or whatever. And that resonates with a working class that's been beaten down and basically suffering through this kind of highly unequal capitalist system for the last 40, 50 years. And so the right's able to kind of mobilize this this kind of opposition to climate on the basis of a kind of class appeal that says this is going to cost your life economically. And you're absolutely right. Like, a lot of liberals just play right into it because a lot of their politics ultimately is about kind of performing this low carbon virtuous life and performing this kind of these individual consumption acts. And that, you know, we need to get beyond that and actually speak to how we can combine climate action with policies that actually improve people's lives, make their access to energy systems more secure and things like that. So.
And in terms of who's driving the climate conversation, let's talk about the makeup of those people and how it probably influences the rhetoric. Because I think that fits well into what we just touched on. Using PMC can seem maybe just a little tired to a degree, but those are the kinds of people, right, who are in charge of this discourse. I mean, yes, it's scientists too, but, you know, relying on data to sell your political project is not a good way to go. But maybe if you can expand on that, how the makeup of the people, the kinds of professional types who are leading climate discourse has affected the way that it's been portrayed.
Yeah, it's funny. I submitted the book proposal in 2017 that was going to be anchored in this very PMC analysis. And for those that don't know, the professional managerial class was a concept coined by Barbara and John Ehrenreich in the 1970s. And then after 2017, basically the left blew up with this debate over the PMC, and it polarized the 2020 primary between the Bernie and Warren factions, and it became this extremely polarizing concept. But I had to soldier through because I really think it's important to thinking about climate politics, because if you look around about who's really driving climate advocacy, it is what you would call the professional managerial class. And I would actually include scientists as really a big part of that class. People, the way I define it in the book is people that try to marshal credentials of some kind to carve out advantages in the labor market. And that can be degrees or licenses or any types of things. But essentially, it's mostly like using hyper educated degrees to kind of create these kind of professional secure middle class types of advantages in the labor market. And so we're talking about academics, scientists, journalists, people that work at NGOs, staffers at NGOs, government bureaucrats, agents, people like this. And this is the kind of class of people that are most vocal about climate change. And essentially, like, there's a couple things that kind of define this class project in a kind of material and ideological sense. The first would be that because they're so invested in using credentials and knowledge to gain these advantages, they're really into making climate politics really about science and knowledge and belief, believing the science and belief in denial, and really vilifying the right, not because they sanction fossil fuel extraction for profit, but more because they fund denial and they're denying the truth and they're doing a war against facts or whatever. And this really came to a fever pitch in the Trump years, right? Because it was just the sort of like from an administration that was denying truth, denying science. And if you recall, we had a March for Science. And if you kind of just go on Google Images and look at like the types of folks that went out to the March for Science, and that can be seen as like a mass action of the professional class. And the other thing about this class is, and there's a debate on whether or not we should call them a class. You could call them a stratum or a class, whatever. But is that they, you know, the class project is about attaining some level of material economic security, like a sort of a middle class job in academia and journalism or whatever it might be. And so that for and again, we should be clear that that's becoming more and more out of reach for much of what could be called the PMC. Like people that follow sort of DSA politics will probably be familiar with this idea that DSA is kind of this place where downwardly mobile college educated people are fleeing to, and people that are working low wage working class jobs, but have these credentials because there's just not jobs anymore for these types of credentialed people. But the goal, obviously, is to try to use these credentials to gain this kind of middle-class security. But with that, with middle-class security comes this level of consumption that is comfortable and might involve, like, owning a car and even owning a home, maybe. And so, and maybe, like, having to fly a lot for professional sort of professional reasons. And so with this middle-class security, a lot of the PMC discourse becomes really focused on their own consumption as the driver, because they're participating at such a high level in these systems of consumption. They feel like instead of blaming the owners of production that I said before are really to blame, they blame themselves and say, it's really, you know, I'm engaging in this high consumption lifestyle while the world burns. And so there's this level of what I call carbon guilt and feelings of complicity. And so those are kind of the two forms of climate politics that I see really predominant amongst this PMC group.
It's not a coincidence that the same group of people are all about like lean-in style feminism, white fragility style racial reckoning, and also individualistic climate action. Like, those things can all fit in some sort of thesis that I haven't been able to flush out yet, or you could just call them PMC and be done with it, really.
Well, I don't know if you've ever had Catherine Liu on, but she wrote a book on the PMC called Virtue Hoarders. And to me, that title, it just really does get at a lot of what's going on here. Basically, virtue and projecting it as this sort of stuff that's really not of the masses, right? Because part of the PMC thing is kind of sneering at the masses. You know, the people that go to the mall or something are what's really destroying climate change. And so hogging this kind of virtue by putting solar panels on your roof or eating organic or going vegan, like, this becomes the key kind of politics. And you can translate it to all various other forms, as you just said.
So let's talk about these strategies that the three strategies that you lay out that this group of folks, scientists,
yes,
PMC types, you know, whatever, lawyers, journalists, et cetera, seem to emphasize. And we've talked about it, I guess, you know, a good amount. But if you don't mind giving those three points and laying that out for us.
So I kind of lay out three archetypes of the PMC climate activists. The first is what I call the science communicator, and I've talked a lot about that, which is essentially, but it does subscribe to this very kind of liberal theory of change, that if the masses really understood and knew the truth about climate change, then action would inevitably follow in a democracy, which I think more and more we're seeing that we don't really live in a democracy. But this this idea that the real problem with the climate crisis is denial of the science, and we just need to kind of make people aware. And so obviously there's a lot of prominent climate scientists who have become really, you know, powerful spokespeople. But I think there's also a whole kind of cadre of journalists and other, I don't know, I guess you call them influencers now, who are really sort of invested in what the science has to say and like trying to fight denial of it, right? So the science communicators, the next one is what I call the policy technocrats. And these are the folks that really propose a whole set of like policy technocratic fixes to the climate crisis. And these really emerged in the 1980s and 90s. It's sort of during the heyday of the kind of neoliberal revolution towards free market policies. And these policy technocrats sort of seeded the ground and said, okay, the right Reagan revolution has won. We need to design kind of really clever, smart policies that are grounded in free market ideas that can win over not only Democrats, but they even have the idea that they can win over Republicans with these really smart technocratic policies. Now, these are things like carbon taxes or cap and trade type market where you can like trade emission credits that give people certain rights or property rights to pollute and then create a market in these emission rights. And ultimately it boils down to this idea that the market is not adequately pricing the emissions of climate change, so that if we can just get the prices right and internalize these emission, the cost of these emissions through carbon pricing, then the market will just solve it naturally. And so the policy technocrats have been banging this drum for decades about how smart this policy is of carbon pricing. Let's put a price on carbon. But you know, as we've hinted at before, like it might be smart to them, but when you actually try to implement this, it ultimately leads to raising the price of energy. And you see how, I mean, we're just seeing that now with inflation, but in France, when Macron tried to implement a fuel tax under the banner of climate action, it led to this kind of working class revolt amongst the yellow vest. You know, they've tried to pass a carbon tax in the very like green liberal state of Washington in 2016 and 2018. It failed miserably. So these very smart solutions amongst the technocrats are not popular. They're not even trying to like have mass appeal. They just sort of appeal to these very policy oriented people. And one of the organizations I profile is called the Citizens Climate Lobby, and their kind of flagship policy is something called a carbon fee and dividend. And one of their slogans is, we're going to outsmart climate change. And to me, that really epitomized this idea that like, we're really smart. We're going to come up with these smart policies and we're going to outsmart this horrific global planetary thing that's facing us.
And the idea that we're going to outsource the effects of climate change or the consequences of it to regular people in the form of like some sort of individual taxation, as opposed to just targeting the producers, the capitalists, the oil executive, or the oil companies at the crux of this. I mean, you mentioned France there, and this France just nationalized its I think yesterday. This is not an oil company. I believe it's nuclear and other kinds of energy, but its largest utility company after the war in Ukraine has basically just caused so much. I mean, talk about the free market failing in terms of energy. We're seeing that right now with gas prices and the way that oil producers are holding the rest of the world hostage to this degree. Yeah. Like, we need to be talking about nationalizing these oil companies, and that is the most straightforward solution, in my opinion. But when you talk about outsmarting climate change, it's hilarious to me that the smartest solution is the simplest one that we keep returning to. And what outsmarting climate change really means is, how can we burden regular people more by avoiding, through our own cowardice and inability to actually stand up to powerful people, targeting the companies, the production of the of oil and of what's causing the worst of climate change.
Yeah, I came up when I was writing this book. I came up with a little pithy slogan that we should not tax molecules. We should tax the rich, which is it's insane because the idea of a carbon tax. Carbon is this neutral stuff that working class people use, you and I use, rich people use, and this idea that it's causing climate change. We're going to tax this neutral stuff. It can easily be turned into something that's going to be a tax on everyone, right? And no one likes that. So, you know, traditionally when the left was powerful, the main way the left got stuff done is through mass redistribution of wealth, and that's through taxing the rich. And so we need a massive and taxing of the rich. And by the way, over the last 40 years, nothing but tax cuts for the rich, you know, from Reagan through W through Trump, like that's just what they've been doing. And so we could, and that even, you know, like if we don't even want to, I mean, obviously I'm all on board for nationalizing the energy sector. I think that's something ultimately we have to do. But if we could just like make our tax regime way more progressive and generate a huge amount of revenue to actually invest in remaking our energy system and remaking our infrastructure, like that kind of big, let's say like New Deal style sort of public goods, public investment regime, and you know, in the New Deal, they tax the rich at these incredible levels too. That's what we need. And focusing on the molecules sort of distracts us from this class struggle that we're facing, and what we need to do to solve it.
It is, I'm hoping we can, flesh out the class struggle element even more, because as you mentioned, and we talked about, the people dominating discourse are the professional managerial types, etc. Poor people are essentially left out of climate debate, and not just poor people within the United States, but the global South is largely ignored, and the global South is going to bear the brunt of how of climate change as it continues to wreak havoc on the planet. Can you talk about that dynamic, and particularly how global capitalism has made nations in the global South vulnerable, and how at the same time they're also given zero voice for the most part in the international climate debate?
Yeah, well, I would actually tweak that a little, because I think when you go into these PMC climate, they often call them like climate justice spaces, and actually they are very keen on they would say centering the frontline communities that are going to bear the worst consequences of climate change. And the whole conception of climate justice is that these poor marginalized communities like indigenous peoples and peasant communities who are really trying to subsist from the land and from nature directly and are seeing droughts and floods and horrific consequences, right, directly. And I think that's super important, and this climate justice framing is really powerful morally. But what that framing leaves out is that it focuses so on this kind of very small marginalized populations that it leaves out the greater mass of the working class, as I would say, in a capitalist society, because most of us don't actually rely on the land for our subsistence. And most of us are just, you know, trying to survive in the market by gaining a wage or an income. And so this kind of constant focus on these frontline communities and marginalized communities ultimately like is creating this somewhat minoritarian politics that doesn't quite, you know, doesn't really speak to the greater masses of the working class. So what I argue is that to actually build the kind of power to deliver for those poor marginalized groups that are really suffering under, you know, sometimes directly by fossil capital, like, you know, like extraction and refineries and all these horrific projects like the Dakota Access Pipeline going through Standing Rock and all these things, you know, to win on those struggles, we actually need to defeat, you know, the same people, oil companies, big capital. We need to build the power to defeat them. And to do that, you actually need to appeal not just to the morality of these disenfranchised marginalized groups, but you need to appeal to the broader mass of the working class. So what I argue, and, you know, it wasn't just me, it's like I think that the genius of the idea of a Green New Deal was that it was going to be a climate program that basically centered just these sort of material gains for everyday working people in a highly unequal capitalist system. So things like a job guarantee, Medicare for all, things like instead of a carbon tax, how about cheaper, even free electricity as a human right? Like these kinds of public goods, delivering material gains to the broader masses of working class people, could be a way to actually build the power. And then ultimately, I think when you bring up this global South issue, it's really important to realize that in terms of global emissions, historically, the United States is by far the greatest emitter. It's by far the worst, violator of international. It's always the agent in these international treaty negotiations, whether it be Copenhagen or Kyoto or wherever it was last year. I'm blanking, but it's the United States,
Scotland, right?
Glasgow. Yeah, Glasgow. United States is always sort of the one messing everything up. And the worst case of that was Obama in 2009. He just like threw a hand grenade at the whole system and it fell apart. So the U.S. has been the biggest barrier to international climate cooperation and climate action. So if we could build a kind of Green New Deal type politics in the U.S., it wouldn't just have to be about decarbonizing the U.S. It'd have to be about transferring these green technologies to the world. And, you know, it's kind of like similar to this vaccine issue, like allowing this technology to really be expanded to the entire world so that the whole world can deal with this global issue instead of just the wealthier parts of the world.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if Biden's not going to waive vaccine intellectual property protections, I doubt he'll do it for electric vehicles or solar or whatever. You know, I mean, like the United States is behind, frankly, in terms of mm-hmm. like capitalist terms on the production of those because of the strength of the Republican Party in this country. So they're going to try to milk that once that's more widely proliferated for everything that it's worth. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the concept of how deindustrialization in the United States has influenced this debate, because largely for decades, the United States has been a service economy for the most part. Mm-hmm. Industrial production has been outsourced to other nations, poorer nations, and we're bearing the brunt of that during COVID in terms of like the global supply chain being so complex that's been disrupted, and the United States does not have the capability or redundancy here domestically to reckon with it. But I also think it influences the politics around climate change that in a way that it is not influenced, or it's more unique here than it is in other nations. Do you agree with that sentiment? And how so, if so?
Yeah, it's a big issue because ultimately climate change is about our industrial production system. It's the Industrial Revolution 250 years ago was about essentially using coal, a fossil fuel, to power these mechanical machines like steam engines and eventually locomotives. And that kind of big industrial breakthrough was rooted in fossil fuels. And that's kind of, we're still stuck with this problem where we use fossil fuels to power these really incredible machines that are rooted back in the Industrial Revolution. But as you were hinting, like essentially what's happened is the United States and many other rich countries went through this Industrial Revolution and the working class got quite organized and built up incredible power through unions and political parties to actually build a political regime that benefited those workers to some degree. And this kind of reached its heyday in the post World War II era of, this sort of Fordist, high unionized regime where capitalism for a short 25 years was actually like sort of redistributing wealth in a somewhat egalitarian way. But of course, as you suggested, what happened was capital got, their profitability started to suffer, and they decided, well, we don't want to deal with these unions and this redistributive states anymore. So we're going to offshore capital around the world, or we're going to automate away these jobs to get rid of these pesky unionized workers. And that kind of process really disempowered the industrial working class and really hollowed out a lot of these former industrial regions that we still see today, whether it be Ohio or Pennsylvania, which has now become like Trump country, you know. And at that same time was where we saw the rise of, yes, a service economy, which was based on like extremely low wage, precarious type of work, but also this sort of rise of higher education as this pathway to a sort of a more secure knowledge economy. And that just sort of widened the wider inequality in society as a whole. So you have this problem where the crisis of climate change is caused by our industrial production system. But most people in our society don't have a lot of contact with that system. And the PMC people really just sort of look at industrial production as just the stuff out there that's kind of causing injustice and causing harm, and we just need to stop it. But I think reviving kind of that old, more sort of old socialist tradition of like actually building up working class power over the industrial production system to transform it, to seize it and transform it is actually what we need to recover, because that's ultimately what the climate crisis is really about. It's about building a bunch of new industrial stuff, and you can a big wind farm. There's very few things that are more industrial than that, but it's going to have to include a whole host of other things like transmission lines and even things like possibly like nuclear plants. And this industrial infrastructure is what we ultimately need to transform. But we again have experienced sort of decades of disempowering the workers that really do the work in those industrial systems.
So I before we wrap, I wanted to pick your brain on the concept of degrowth, right? Where, you know, I sometimes we'll have people write in and say that degrowth politics are the way to go in order to combat climate change. And I am incredibly skeptical of those kinds of arguments because, again, I don't find it feasible, nor do I think it is nor do I think that it fits into the like the larger class struggle that we want to emphasize here. But what is your opinion on some of those calls and how that fits into the larger climate debate?
Well, you know, the whole problem is if you look up degrowth, if you look up D as a prefix, it means less. It means privation. It means we're going to like scale down. And if you look around about its various definitions of degrowth, it's always centering reduction, less, how to live better with less. It centers downscaling, and ultimately their politics really focuses on this kind of aggregate scaling down of the economy. And I should say, because I get in trouble on these debates, that there's a lot of things they propose that I would agree with. They propose decommodifying social, you know, public services. They propose a shorter work week and things like this that any leftist is going to be behind, you know. But this, the way in which they frame the debate is always centering less and always centering reduction. And again, for the mass of the working class in countries like the United States, so-called rich countries, they've seen nothing but less for the last several decades. They've seen stagnating wages. They've seen their benefits cut. They've seen the welfare state hollowed out. And so always centering less in a politics of reduction to a working class that is already suffering through austerity is just strategically doesn't make a lot of sense. And a more traditional class struggle approach to politics is to say we need to, you can even say degrow the rich. We need to take from the rich to give more, to give a increase to the working class and to the masses, and you know, less for the few and more for the many. So this kind of class struggle is about really taking from the rich to make life for everyone better and more secure. And when you talk about either growth or GDP growth, it's always at the aggregate of society. It's kind of like this aggregate measure that conceals the more divisions and class struggles in society.
Yeah.
And so we really need to have that language of division and conflict between classes. And the one last thing I'll say is they often say, we get that. And we don't want to degrow the poor countries of the global South, right? We just want to degrow the rich countries, right? But when they even say that, they'll often say, we're going to degrow the global North, but this will allow the global South countries to grow. But as I was just suggesting, global North countries are not these aggregate entities. They have huge amounts of poor people and struggling working class people. So saying that we're going to degrow your whole country doesn't help this problem either.
And in terms of those politics, it sounds a little bit too close to austerity politics. And we always know who bears the brunt of austerity politics.
For sure.
All right. Well, Matt Huber, can't thank you enough. Amazing discussion today. Author of Climate Change as Class War, Building Socialism on a Warming Planet. Matt will put the link to your book in the podcast description and in the YouTube description and anywhere else that you are listening/watching this program. Thanks so much for your time today, Matt. Really appreciate it. Good to talk to you again.
Really great honor to be on the program. Thanks so much.
Oh, an honor. Wow. All right. Well, with that said, we are going to wrap up the free hour of this program and head into the fun half, where we'll be taking your calls. 646-257-3920 is the number. We will be reading your IMs. We have some responses to that interview, and we'll be joined by Matt Binder and Brandon Sutton for discussions. Maybe we'll be making fun of some right-wingers. I would love to have a Jordan Peterson segment every day. That's how much joy I get making fun of him.
I'll have to scrounge something up. I haven't seen anything.
Yeah, I don't know if we had it, but because we had one yesterday and we had one the day before, and I just realized, like, he's definitely my favorite right-winger to make fun of right now.
Yeah, and I do have a new drop that I forgot to upload into SoundPulse.
But do the other one.
Okay, yeah, here's...
As I'm going to ask you to plug what happened last night on Left Reckoning.
Sons of bitches.
Actually, very similar conversation to the one just had with Matt Huber. Lee Phillips to talk about a lot of similar stuff, basically. So if you want to...
Double up on that...
And also, we got into more Rogan, DeSantis, Tim Pool stuff in the fun half. I got in the post game last night for Patreon.com/LeftReckoning. Did a deep dive into all of Ron DeSantis's the ways he's attacking public teachers, the Don't Say Gay stuff, the Hillsdale College stuff, where they had. The other thing.
The test for your politics, right?
Well, there's that too, which people are downplaying, but. You know that thing where a certain number of math textbooks were discovered to be like too woke or something?
Mm-hmm.
So out of 150 reviewers of math textbooks, only 3 found problems with it. 2 of those had direct connections to Hillsdale College. One of them was a sophomore in political science at Hillsdale College, which is not in Florida. It's in Michigan. And it's a sort of like they teach you that like George Washington cherry tree story was actually true. That's the type of level of education. So. I call that segment Make Florida Students Dumb Again, which is what DeSantis is doing. So check that out, patreon.com/leftreckoning last night.
All right. Well, we have Binder, but since you're flying solo, Matt, maybe we need to take a break before we bring him in. There he is. Let's just, there we go. There he is. Hey.
Hello, everybody. Hello, Emma. Hello, Matt. I see that Brendan's not here yet, and Bradley is away on vacation.
He is. I've been seeing some of his photos. He's at a national park. I won't say where. It looks very, very nice. Yeah. Anyway.
He did text me to say, you know, there was a show because no one... He's got no one.
Yes.
Whoops!
But I had to.
Sons
I had
of
to
bitches.
I had to immediately.
I wonder when
tell
I'm gonna
Bradley,
get used to that.
I had to immediately tell Bradley to get back to vacation immediately, because otherwise we'll see who cancels who first. do you have that one? Do you have that?
Oh,
clip
I have
as well?
That. I have that. I can send it to Matt, but. Well,
right now, it's just
sons of bitches.
That's all we got.
I love it.
All right. So, what's happening in on Doomed and Scam Economy?
Sure. So, on Doomed on Tuesday, I had a show where basically we went through what we knew about the ideology and background of the Highland Park shooter. Because, you know, this guy is a little bit different than what most people, I think, are looking for in a shooter with his, you know, he's a nihilistic, like, doomer type. Certainly fell into right-wing politics, but this isn't someone who's motivated by, like, MAGA or anything like that. He's motivated by, like, their actual, like, wants. He's more motivated by, like, the nihilism and, you know, the anti-everything that they sort of put out. So we sort of went through that on this on Doomed on this past Tuesday. You could check that out. And then on Scam Economy tonight, live at 9 p.m. Eastern time, I will be talking to Ed Zitron about Voyager, another crypto lending platform that has filed for bankruptcy. And the interesting part about Voyager is that they claim to have been FDIC insured. That does not seem to be the case. They seem to have misled their customers. We sort of get into the whole broad crypto lending sphere as it is, the whole space, and you know, how very centralized this decentralized world is. And so that's tonight, 9 p.m. at youtube.com/MattBinder and scameconomy.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Awesome. I'm almost hoping the crypto grift stays around for a little bit longer, even though it's falling apart, just so, like, you continue to have material.
It's definitely here.
It'll last? All right, great. I should have touched on that with Matt Huber about crypto mining and how that's so terrible for the environment. But anyway, Brandon, what's up?
Sorry for being tardy, everyone. I didn't know we were going today.
Yeah, well, it's because Bradley wasn't here, and we are lost without him. But what's happening over on the discourse, Brandon?
Nothing yet, but ideally we'll have another episode out for you by the end of the week. I will say I have been also following the crypto news very, very closely, and I've been trying to get my co-host to let me speak at them about my obsession with what's been happening. And so I think they've been avoiding me because of that. I might just have to invite Matt on to let me speak to him about it.
Yeah, he would be a lovely guest. Look at that.
Yeah, we should definitely.
I'd be a guest on either of your guys' shows if you even asked.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. I should really? Do that. Well, to be fair, it took me 200 episodes to ask Sam Cedar to come on my show.
There you go. All right, so they'll take on episode 400. Maybe I'll come on.
To be fair,
I feel bad.
Well, my original plan was, after I saw how long it took for Sam to come on the show, I was like, oh, I should have Sam on as the big 100th episode guest. And then the 100th episode just happened to line up perfectly with the COVID. The COVID pandemic starting.
Ah.
So I was like, maybe I shouldn't be celebrating the 100th episode while everybody is, at least here in New York City at the time, dying. Hmm. So that got pushed back, and then it just ended up being the 200th episode.
Well, there you go. With that said, we're going to head into the fun half, 646-257-3920. See you there.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority
Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Fun.
What is up, everyone?
Fun.
Nomi Keen.
You did it.
Fun.
Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon.
Fun. Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this,
7A?
Yes.
Me? Is it?
Yes?
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello? Is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go start off.
Who libertarians?
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion. Sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less.
But let me say this.
Poop.
Call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick, so screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.